This week we've been hearing how states are funding their public pension plans. Today, why Illinois is the worst in the nation when it comes to setting aside enough money for state workers and retirees. Illinois has socked away less than half the money that's been promised for public pensions, and that big gap keeps growing. NPR's David Shaper wraps up our series with this report.
Illinois has five public pension funds for teachers, state employees, university employees, judges, and legislators. Think of them as one big home mortgage. And instead of making the required house payments, Illinois' governors and state lawmakers have been paying much less than they should, even skipping some payments and borrowing money to make others.
Basically, the state of Illinois is upside down on its home mortgage, and it's maxed out its credit cards, and it's applying for more credit cards.
Lawrence Massal is president of the Chicago-based Civic Federation, which keeps tabs on government finances. He says Illinois has so badly underfunded its pensions that the unfunded liability has ballooned to a whopping $78 billion.
That means every man, woman, and child in the state of Illinois is on the hook for $6,031 of pension promises that we don't have the assets for.
Ms. Saul and others say Illinois' pension deficit has exploded in recent years because the state's politicians have used budget gimmicks. They've taken pension holidays and they've borrowed heavily. Just this January, Illinois issued $3.5 billion in pension obligation bonds to make this year's pension payment. So the state has to begin paying that borrowed money back next year to the tune of $800 million. Illinois' bond rating is now lower than any other state's except California's, so it pays high interest rates. And if its bond rating goes any lower, Illinois soon may not be able to borrow money at all. Eden Martin is president of the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago, a business group. He says while the politicians have been underfunding Illinois' pensions, they've also sweetened pension benefits.
For example, in Illinois, if you're a state employee, you can retire at either 60 or 55, depending on which pension plan you're in, with a full pension if you have enough years in the pension system. That's pretty early.
Martin says early retirement incentives over the years have thousands more retirees drawing pension checks for longer periods of time. He adds that Illinois retirees get automatic 3% annual pay increases, regardless of the rate of inflation, and the state pays their health insurance premium.
The pensions have become, with the passage of time, more generous, out of sync with what's going on in the private sector, and that's where reform has to happen.
Martin's group and others are pushing for Illinois to raise the retirement age and to implement a two-tiered retirement system so future state employees would be on a defined contribution plan instead of the defined benefit system in place now. Illinois' constitution prohibits a reduction in benefits earned by current retirees and employees. And many of those retirees say they're hardly living high on the hog as has been portrayed.
Okay, this is my living room. You see, there's nothing fancy in here.
70-year-old Ida Calloway shows off her modest three-bedroom ranch home in Chicago's south suburbs. Calloway worked for the state for 24 years as a mental health technician, bathing, dressing, and feeding people with developmental disabilities in a state home.
There were some who couldn't walk, couldn't feed themselves. I know I had to learn how to massage food down their throat. It was hard. You get feces thrown on you. You get spit on.
Calloway says she deserves every penny of her $1,473 a month pension, and she doesn't think it's fair to reduce benefits for current and future state employees who do this kind of work. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Illinois' pension benefits are on or below par with other states. The union's Hank Sheff says employees contribute at least 4% of their pre-tax salary into the pension funds, and he argues they shouldn't be asked to give up benefits or pay more.
I mean, if the problem was created by underfunding, the solution is funding.
Current and retired state workers were among the groups rallying at the Illinois Capitol earlier this month for a big tax increase to, in part, better fund the pension plans. They're a potent political force, which makes lawmakers queasy about reducing benefits and raising taxes in this election year. But the experts say kicking the can down the road, as Illinois has done so many times before, only moves this state's pension funds closer to the brink of going broke within the next decade. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
You can hear more stories in our series Deferred Promises, America's Pension Crisis, at our website, npr.org. The draw of 3D games and TV could keep some people at home in the future, but the recession is keeping millions of people at home right now. For many men, that might also mean staying at home to care for the kids. By some estimates, there are about 2 million men who are primary caregivers for their children. That number was already on the rise before the recession started. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, some stay-at-home dads are thinking about how they'll approach rejoining the workforce eventually.
It's another manic Monday. A dozen toddlers and small children have laid this suburban Washington, D.C. living room to waste. Their dads, many of whom got sidelined by the recession, are exchanging baby photos and discussing getting their kids to try tofu. Rami Cohen is a regular at the stay-at-home dad's playgroup. He says he loves being a full-time dad, though it divides his attention.
It's been really wonderful. And we found that... need help with that? Here. You can ease and lower this part.
Business at Cohen's architecture firm went south with the downturn. Employees got furloughed, first to 2 days a week and then to none.
Eventually, this is all going to turn around, and eventually work is going to come back and speed back up. That's great.
Cohen says when the economy does pick up, he'll be torn about whether he wants to go back to the office full time, especially because he has another child on the way. Kevin Folk already has two. Last summer, the father of 11-month-old twins was laid off from a sales job with the National Association of Home Builders. He says he approaches his new line of work kind of like he did the old one. He networks with the other at-home dads and picks up tips.
For example, we had these little things, mesh things that you put fruit in. I didn't know about those things.
Folk says he's looking to re-enter the workforce, at least part-time. But he says it's hard. For starters, try doing a job interview on the phone with babies crying and crawling around. Also, he says, he wondered whether he should put his daddy gig on the resume. So he consulted some experts in human resources.
And they said, absolutely. You want to include that as this is why you're at home. You know, you were doing something and might show, you know, some, especially, I don't know, I always say, like, well, twins, talk about, you know, being able to prioritize and manage. It's pretty tough.
Jeremy Adam Smith wrote a book called The Daddy Shift after his stint staying at home. This is what he says about having at-home caregiving on the resume.
Yeah, it's a liability.
Moms who take a hiatus from work have been dealing with this for a lot longer. But Smith says now that men are staying home in greater numbers, they're having to confront the same reality.
When they're knocked out of the workforce or they take time out of the workforce to take care of children, they're going to lose a little bit of ground. And I think we should just need to be realistic about that.
Back at the Monday morning playgroup in Arlington, Virginia, Dave Cavey is not ready to concede losing too much ground. The former Marine wasn't able to find work after the family moved from Abu Dhabi last summer. He eventually gave up the job search, pulled the kids out of expensive daycare, and now volunteers at various places.
Like, for example, City of Alexandria, the National Park Service, our condo association, where we're new homeowners, running for a position on the board of directors there. So I'm trying to do some things to kind of pad my resume.
Over on the other side of the room, Michael J. Madsen is showing off baby photographs. Madsen just sent his notice giving up his part-time gig teaching commercial photography. When he does re-enter the workforce, he says he'll do so as a baby photographer.
And this time actually is helping me build my portfolio because I can shoot babies.
But right now, Madsen is more concerned about recruiting other dads to join him for playdates at the ballpark.
Jensen and I are going to hit the park.
Madsen says he loves being a homemaker, but of course every job has its drawbacks.
Poop. Poop is the biggest downside.
And that's not all.
I'm horrible at washing dishes and cleaning up, but there's got to be a downside to every job, otherwise it wouldn't be a job.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
California's budget crisis is putting the crunch on the state's prisons and county jails. Scores of nonviolent offenders are being released early, in part to save money. In Los Angeles County, the sheriff says he doesn't like it, but he can't ignore the dwindling numbers in his jail budget. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports. Inmates typically get out of jail early for good behavior, but over the past 3 months, more than 350 L.A. County inmates have been handed what amounts to a get-out-of-jail-free card. Anthony Vargas left the county's Twin Tower jail after serving half the time he was supposed to for forging a prescription and commercial burglary.
Yeah, it's called day by day. Every day you serve in jail counts as 2 days.
Another just-released inmate, Steve Gutierrez, was sentenced to 80 days behind bars for driving without a license and for violating a restraining order. But he served just 10 days and left jail wearing an ankle bracelet to monitor his movements.
Good for me. Who wants to shower next to all these men? Who wants to have to go to the restroom next to all these guys? You don't. The food is terrible, and you're freezing to death in there because it's bad.
The early release program was intended for people like Gutierrez, people who are not known gang members, who don't have a violent criminal history.
People with Mickey Mouse crimes, like tickets, you know. Like myself, I haven't been in trouble for 7 years. I proved myself. Give me a break.
L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca says budget shortfalls are forcing him to release inmates like these early. He's trying to cut $128 million from jail operations. Baca's also eliminated overtime pay for his deputies, and he's even getting back in a patrol car himself every Friday.
Well, no one likes early release, and I don't like it, and I don't think the governor likes it, and no city wants it. And the whole point of it all is that money does matter. And public safety should be the last thing cut out of government.
Baca says he'd rather inmates serve at least 80% of their sentences. But years ago, the L.A. County jails were so jam-packed, inmates were released after serving just 10% of their jail time. Sheriff spokesman Steve Whitmore says back then, a federal judge ruled the overcrowding amounted to cruel and unusual punishment.
We had people sleeping on the roof of Men's Central Jail. We had 10,000 people. We had people in the hallways. We had, it was just brimming. And so the judge said, you can't do this anymore. You got to get them off the roof.
Today, California prisons are under order to reduce overcrowding. That's resulted in a new state law that's being applied to some county jails. But in Los Angeles, it's money that's driving the releases. UCLA Professor Michael Stoll says others around the country are doing the same.
Most states are experimenting with releasing nonviolent low-level offenders, in part because most states have faced the same kind of budget crisis that California is facing.
But some people fear the kind of scenario that happened in Sacramento last month. The sheriff's department released 22-year-old Kevin Peterson after serving only half his 4-month sentence for violating probation. Less than a day later, Peterson was arrested for attempted rape. Professor Stoll says that's a rare instance.
Granted, you're going to find in every state a case in which you've released someone early from prison and they go on and recommit a crime. Some of them are going to be more heinous than others. I mean, even when people serve out their time and are released from prison unconditionally, there's always going to be that risk too.
Sheriff Lieutenant Kevin Kuykendall says inmates are carefully screened before they're released and monitored once they get out. But he says letting them out early is still a big deal.
I think all inmates should serve 100% of their time. But fiscal constraints, the economy the way it is, doesn't allow us to do that.
Camille Blaze walked out of jail after serving only half his 6-month drunk driving sentence.
Anyone get out of the hellhole early, it's a good thing, you know what I mean? It's not like I'm not a rapist, a murderer, you don't have to lock your doors, hide your children.
Now that he's out, Blaze says he's already enrolled in school with a part-time job.
I'm already contributing to society as opposed to taking away, as your tax dollars would pay for me be sitting in there, and it does anybody any good, no one.
The real test of the early release program is if former inmates like Blaze can stay out of trouble and out of jail. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
The precarious financial position of Greece is still shaking markets and affecting the euro. The Greek debt problem will dominate a European Union summit in Brussels today. The Greek government has announced austerity measures, and it's promising to increase revenue by getting Greeks to pay their taxes. But as NPR's Eric Westerfeld reports, that will not be easy.
Diomidis Spanellis has a spectacular view of the Acropolis from his Athens office, but the new head of information systems at the Greek Ministry of Finance these days has no time to admire the 2,500-year-old view. The 43-year-old computer dynamo is working overtime to install a new state-of-the-art auditing, billing, and accounting system to track down tax offenders in a nation where tax cheating is nearly as common as jaywalking. But there's a big problem. New auditing has taken a back seat to a fight over who provides the hardware.
Companies arguing whether they should be awarded the contract and fighting against each other.
How many years have they been arguing over the hardware?
More than 2 years. The software is ready, but there's no hardware in which to run it, and these are problems.
It's just one example of the enormous challenges the Greeks face in overhauling a tax system that was not computerized until 2000. Even today, rural areas in Greece still rely mostly on paper records. The government estimates that the underground, untaxed economy in Greece is nearly one-third of gross domestic product and accounts for billions in uncollected taxes. Kostas Bakouras with the anti-corruption group Transparency International says the Greek tolerance for tax cheating is high. He says the self-employed, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, and the like are big offenders, but the biggest, Bakouras says, are from high-paid, white-collar professions.
For example, doctors, lawyers, architects, and engineers, who, when they provide services, they don't give receipts unless they ask for, and therefore, if they don't provide receipts, they don't declare their income. We say it's unacceptable, but then when we get somebody, they say, oh, the poor guy, he has 3 kids, he's not going to do it again, leave him alone. So these things have to stop.
But few think it will stop as long as Greeks continue to have no faith in the state to use their taxes wisely. Athens University economist George Bitros says an ineffectual public sector consistently fails to deliver, from garbage collection and transport to basic bureaucracy.
You pay taxes and you don't get anything. If the Greek state fails, Greeks take the law in their hands. If they don't correct the delivery of public services, every one of us will have an incentive to tax evade.
A Louis Prima song seeps out of the speakers at Nikos Stadalis' largely empty bar and cafe in the Pisiri neighborhood of Athens. Since the 2004 Olympics, his business is down dramatically. Stadalis says he can no longer afford to pay his federal or local taxes. He may have to file for bankruptcy. He says he owes the equivalent of about $50,000.
Everyone doesn't pay taxes. I have to pay the last 2 years. I haven't paid them yet. And I'm not sure I'm going to make it. I have to close this thing.
Dadalis complains that affluent, politically well-connected Greeks use loopholes, offshore accounts, and old-fashioned bribery to get off paying taxes, while small businessmen like him are left to shoulder the burden or sink. In any case, Dadalis says he doesn't worry about getting caught.
So what? They could do me nothing. They're going to kill me. Why? By the time that I have money, I will pay them. But I don't have that money.
Dadalis has little reason to fear the tax collector. Few in Greece are ever held accountable. In 2007, the latest year for which data is available, only 10 people in the nation of more than 11 million were prosecuted for tax evasion or tax-related crimes. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Athens.